Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Preacher Boys podcast, and today's guest is someone like, when I was looking at the calendar a few days ago, I was like, how have we not done this? I feel like I've been fangirling for like two years, and then we met a year ago when you moved to Vegas. Yeah. We're both in Vegas, and that was it. We haven't connected since. So yeah, just introduce yourself a little bit, like give us just a 30-second little backstory, and then we'll dive deep.
Yeah, sure. Well, my name is Isami, and I'm originally from Japan, and then recently moved to Vegas, and then there's been a billion moves in between there. But I grew up super strict, fundamentalist, Baptist. I still identify as Christian, but have re-evaluated a lot of things since leaving where I grew up in. A lot of it was kind of being pushed out,
yeah.
But then also realizing that a lot of the things actually that I grew up thinking were okay, or not.
Yeah.
And then, you know, hearing a lot of people's stories and other survivor stories made me realize what I grew up with was definitely not okay. Yeah. So that's, I'm kind of in that process of still learning and unlearning a lot of things. So yeah. That's where I'm at right now.
Well, you describe yourself a lot as like growing up in like a fake missionary family. Yeah. And like, that's a, when you read that, it's interesting and you can pull some context out of that. Yeah. But when you say that, what do you mean? Like describe kind of your home life, you know, I know that's a broad topic, but when you talk about just in the ministry perspective, what yeah. version of Christianity were you seeing? Cause even fundamentalism, when someone says that, ooh, there's a lot of different layers to it.
It's very multifaceted, of course. Right. I'm like trying to figure out how to explain this. That doesn't take about 8 hours. So just growing up the way I did, my parents had somewhat of a ministry until I was about 15. And yeah. then after that, they figured out a way to do absolutely no work yeah. or just enough to take photos and don't do anything else and still get paid a full-time salary.
Sure.
So that's what I was raised with. Now the home was very abusive even before then. So some of my first memories are of abuse. I don't remember a life before that at all. Mm. When I say that the church that I grew up in was toxic, I mean, it was very controlling, manipulative. Abuse towards women was okay, as long as there was some sort of explanation. Maybe they weren't obeying their husband, or right. if a woman was abused, it was always because of the way she was dressed. It was because of something that she did. The blame was always on the victim. So that's the type of environment that I grew up in. And I would say it was a very, it's tough because I don't want to lump all missionaries in this category. I've sure. met some wonderful people who are there to serve their community, who are there to help people, who genuinely love every single person they come in contact mm-hmm. with. And I think that was not the example that I was given growing up.
Yeah.
A lot of what I was given was very colonized Christianity. And what I mean by that is even down to things like wearing pants. And I know that's a huge hot button subject with churches, because is it do women wear pants? Do women not wear pants? That type of thing. But when it was brought to Japan with that fundamentalist mindset, a lot of the missionaries that came over to Japan were enforcing this because of American traditions. So they were saying things like, the hippies in America wore pants as a form of rebellion in the 60s. So then they pressured that onto Japanese Christians, saying that you must wear a dress to church. Well, we never really went through that. We did have a movement, but Japanese women were wearing pants in World War II.
Yeah.
And prior to that, it's part of their culture. So what I was given was a very whitewashed version of Christianity, as well as a very toxic version of it. And of course, I've learned later on that none of those are okay. But that's what I grew up with, and that's what I thought Christianity was.
Yeah. Well, I'm always fascinated hearing, because it's the reason that I'm always, you know, people get mad at me for one of two things. It's always like, you're too aggressive, or they get mad at me because I go too soft on somebody. And it's always, and I'm sure you get the same feedback, like, call it a cult, do this, or don't make it sound like a cult because it was your version, you know. And I think the breakdown for me is always, did the person who was being abusive know they were being abusive? And also, did they actually believe what they said they believed? Because there's, you know, some people like Jack Hyles, like, I'm convinced, did not believe what he said. But there's a lot of people that follow Jack Hyles that did believe what he said, and they acted in abusive ways because they were following his steps. When you look back at your parents, to the best of your knowledge, do you think they did believe, even if it was wrong or their belief system was bad, do you think they actually believed it in the beginning? Or was it always like, this is an easy way to get some power and money, you know?
That's a great question. I think at one point it did have good intentions. I genuinely do. And I know that might sound like I have like Stockholm syndrome or something, like protecting what they were doing. But I think when it first started out, they had genuine intentions. And the reason I think that is, I do remember them seeing, or me seeing them, try to help the community, try to be present in the community or help other families out. I saw that as a kid, even though abuse was still going on in my home, I still saw that. And then as I got older, I think a lot of it came from anger issues that my dad had that was not cared for. I know there were a lot of things that he went through that he never really worked out, and there were other missionaries that he was working with, and they ended up getting into fights, and they pretty much split up. So that happened when I was about 13, and then everything kind of just went downhill from there. And then at 15 was when they just figured out they didn't really need to do anything. So I think it started out with pure intentions, and then it just, it got very bad.
Well, and you don't have to go into detail on this, but when you talk about abuse too, because again, that's a, you know, there's people talking about, you know, physical abuse. It sounds like with the anger issues, I'm assuming there was physical abuse and things like that. Was it purely that? Was there sexual abuse, or was it something that was, you know, he would get really angry and maybe throw something or be physically abusive?
So with my dad, there was physical abuse from both parents. So I would say the abuse was physical, verbal, and spiritual from both parents. The sexual abuse for me happened with our church pianist. Now, just kind of like looking back at it as an adult, like from a kid's perspective, you would think, oh, like, this is terrible. If I tell my parents, they're going to protect me, right? That's common sense. We would think that. And I thought that as a child. And I actually told my mom what was going on with the sexual abuse. And sometimes it even happened in front of her, but she, refused to protect me. And I think a lot of it was, she might've been scared to tell my dad because of his anger issues. So my dad actually never knew, but also at the same time, my innocence was being exchanged out for free piano lessons for myself and my two siblings. So there was, an exchange happening for my innocence starting at age 9. So that's what I went through as far as sexual abuse is concerned. It was not with my parents. It was with another member in the church.
Gotcha. And I mean, 9 is such a on our business podcast, we always go back to like, tell us about when you're in like middle school or like 9 years old. Cause it is, as much as you can't recognize that version of yourself now, like you look back and go like, what was I at nine? It is when you start becoming you, like, you know, and maybe that's not true. I mean, you're always you, but it's when you start having independence a little bit, you're running around, you're playing, you're figuring out what you like and dislike. What did it do for you seeing this thing of feeling like you're being exchanged, feeling like, even if you couldn't put the words to it then, like to go to your protector and say something's happening and then nothing being done about it. What did that do for you in terms of your faith or your family life?
Well, when I did tell my mom, she, and this is why I wrestled with this whole like blaming myself for years. Yeah. She actually did sit in on a piano lesson once just to prove that I was lying. And then of course, later on, some of the abuse happened in front of her. To me, I felt like I couldn't trust myself. You know, I was telling the truth. I was telling her what was happening. And, you know, the one person who's supposed to believe you, your own mom, doesn't believe you. Or I'm realizing now she did know what was going on. Like, how do you not know? You know, how do you not know when you see it happening in front of you? And then your daughter tells you, you know, what's going on. And you refuse to tell your husband about it because you're afraid of his, you know what's going on at that point. There's no excuse. So looking back now, I understand what that is. I'm even understanding, and this was the hardest part for me to kind of accept as an adult, was that that is actually one of the definitions of human trafficking, is exchanging someone out for either a good or a service. So in my case, it was free piano lessons. So that was really hard for me to wrap my brain around. But as a child, thinking about it, it taught me that I couldn't trust myself. It also made me think that God was okay with what was going on, because my dad was a pastor slash missionary, you know, that, and I was always told you have to honor the man of God. Mm-hmm. Like, you would, God would get angry with you or cause problems in your life if you disobeyed the man of God. So I thought that I was being punished, and I thought that this was something that I had brought on myself, and that, you know, this is just going to be the way I was going to live. I had no say. It also taught me that I had no power over my own life. And I know that as a child, at 9 years old, your parents should still be able to tell you no. Yeah, if you're getting into something you shouldn't be, or maybe you're throwing a rock at another kid, that probably is a bad thing.
Right.
And your parents should tell you, hey, stop that. That's not cool. But it did teach me that I had no power and no voice of my own.
Right.
It taught me that I was not allowed to stand up for myself. And so even the abuse at home that was going on, it made me think that, oh, this is okay. This is normal. I don't have a say over my life.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, transitioning into missionary life, one of the scariest things for me is, I mean, in general, but especially when this kid's involved, is like there's a lack of accountability because you're, and again, I'm not, I mean, I worked with a missions organization, but I mean, but then again, the people that I worked for, at least one of them was, I mean, embezzling a lot of money. Like, I mean, lack of accountability played a role there.
Yeah.
You know, so did you have any tether to anybody else outside, or like anybody who, you know, you could say, oh, this is happening with my parents, or, oh, this is, or was it totally like, this is our little bubble?
So we were actually connected to a military church at one point. From the time I was probably 8 until 13, we were renting a building. So there was a Air Force base. It was in Yokota, Japan. And there was this church that was primarily geared towards the military, but they would allow us to rent part of their building in the afternoon. So in order to keep a good relationship with them, we would attend some of their church services. So I had some friends there, and honestly, a lot of them saved my life and probably still don't know that to this day, where I was allowed to go over to their house. So it was a safe place for me. But after my dad got into some fights with the leadership of that church, we left. And then shortly after, my grandmother passed away. So we ended up inheriting her house. So we moved from renting a space in the English-speaking church to renting another building. And my dad somehow got into another fight with someone else, and then pretty much everyone left. And then there was one family, and then we switched to meeting in our apartment. He made that family upset. They left, and there was nobody. So I'm, 15 at this point? There's nobody coming to our church, and it's in our apartment.
Yeah. It's just your family devotions, basically.
Yeah, basically, or whatever my dad decided to pick on the day.
That's something interesting is, like, I notice these types of guys, and I notice them because I've spent most of my life in church culture. I see it, but they're everywhere. But within churches specifically, there's a very certain stereotype of man where they go from church to church, they are heavily involved, and then they start identifying flaws within those churches and then moving out. But it's, but their circle gets smaller, but they get more power in their circle. Like, it sounds like beyond just the anger issues and blowups that can happen with even rational people, do you feel like your dad was frustrated by not having, like, more control? Like, did he not like being partnering with someone or being subservient to somebody else?
I think that might have had a lot to do with it. He was not very good with any type of constructive criticism. So even if it was in a loving way, he would get very upset. I remember there was one sermon that was actually preached at the English-speaking church, and I was probably 12 at the time. And there was a pastor that came in, and he was talking about how husbands and wives should treat each other. And he said, "Husbands, your wife is the queen of your home. Treat her like a queen." And he was saying that, you know, a lot of times, because it was a military church, and he was also a retired military guy too. And he said, you know, sometimes, you know, we think authority and rank and all these things, and we come home and we don't know why our kids aren't in line. We've been deployed for 6 months, and why doesn't the wife have it together? And he said, no, you don't treat your family that way. Your wife is the queen of your home. You're supposed to respect her. And that set my dad off. He was so angry. And I remember my parents fighting about it. And he said, well, the wife is not the leader of the home. The husband is. I don't know why he thinks she's some sort of authoritative figure. And, like, he lost it. And even at that made him mad. It wasn't even a direct hit at him. It was just a sermon that we were sitting in. So yeah, anytime there was any constructive feedback or, hey, maybe this isn't cool, let's talk about this, it was never accepted well. So it ended up
isolating. Narrowing it down to just you. This is the part of your story that, like, you know, blows my mind that you've shared before. Because, like I said, I worked with somebody in the missions world that was very duplicitous with a lot of stuff. And I found out after leaving that, you know, so much of that. And then you're like, oh, I could have got paid a lot more. But it's one of those things where, I mean, your family was next level, like, straight up just scamming. So, like, what people would come visit, because the only time there was accountability is when other churches would come visit your ministry, right?
I mean, very rare.
Like,
very
like a missions rare. Trip to come meet you. Because, like, I remember you shared a story of your parents had someone that came and visited them, and they did an event where, like, they gave away food, right?
Okay, so this was years later.
Because I was listening, I was like, this is crazy. Like, this is like a movie. Like, this is like...
No, this was years later. So when I was a kid and growing up in the home, anytime a church would say, hey, we'd love to do a mission trip to come see you in Japan, the first thing they would say is, it's so expensive to get from the airport. This is how many fees you're going to pay. So it was always discouraged. So growing up, at least when I was growing up, nobody came to visit. There was not a single person that came in. Now, after I grew up and left the home, their missions director actually came to visit them. And it was still in the house, and there were English students that were there. They're not affiliated with a church whatsoever. But my parents basically told them, oh, there's these people from America coming.
Did your parents do English teaching to help subsidize?
Well, they didn't have anybody pay. So here's where it gets a little complicated. None of their English students pay at all. So then the people there, the local people there, think that my parents are amazing people because they're teaching them English for free. What they don't realize is they're being paid a full-time salary to do no mission work. So these English classes, my mom teaches them. My dad has no connection with it. And my mom uses the English Bible as a textbook, and she teaches them from there. she'll take pictures of them gathering together and then send it back to the States and say, look at the nice little study. We studied the Word of God. If I handed you a Bible in Japanese and said, hey, Eric, what are we learning today? I think you would be here to learn Japanese, not the Bible, right?
Right.
So that doesn't make any sense. But people in the States would eat that up and they would think, oh, wow, they're doing a Bible study. And it was even named, it's actually called Joyful Ladies English or Joyful Ladies Study. So whenever you put that in a prayer letter, it sounds like you have a Bible study, right? So,
and they're not lying technically. Technically,
it's still the Bible. So that's what they would do. So people would just think, oh, these are great people. Like they're teaching me English for free. Meanwhile.
So they're doing good visually to the community, doing good visually to people back home.
Right.
But there's a huge disconnect in what is actually happening.
Absolutely. There's no ministry work. Right. Absolutely none. But they came to, the mission board came to visit a few years back. I would say it's probably been about 5 or 6 years at this point. It's been a while. But they came over to visit, and my parents basically told the English students to show up on Sunday morning. And they said, these Americans will be here, and they'd love to meet you. So we're just going to have like a barbecue, and you guys can come over. So they come over, my dad puts on a suit, and I, when I explain this to people, people get me like, how do you, my dad has a podium. I'm like laughing, trying to explain this. My dad has a podium that has been chopped in half that he puts on top of the kitchen table.
Okay.
So if they ever need to take photos,
he's got the props.
Yeah, he's got the props for it. I mean, okay. Yeah, he's thought this one out, but he would bring that out and then take pictures with the people that, that came over. So that was their church
photo event. Op, yeah,
church event.
So, I mean, going back to you, like, there has to be, you keep alluding to like still figuring out where you're at, but like, I mean, when did you start realizing this is across the board really off? Because like there had to be some party that's like justifying in your mind for years, like, well, this is what the truth is. This is the, you know, my parents are doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. Like how quickly did you start going, or like what age did you start going like, this is fishy, like this is not right?
So, as far as the abuse is concerned, I was probably 9 or 10. I went over to a friend's house, and my lip was swollen, and my dad had punched me that day because I wasn't smiling. So I went over to her house and she saw that it was swollen and she asked if I was okay. And this was a friend on the military base that I was allowed to go visit. And I just said, well, I got in trouble. And she just kind of looked at me and I said, well, doesn't your dad ever hit you when you're in trouble? And she said, no, that never happens. That would be a horrible thing for him to do. And that's when I started.
But you thought that was completely normal.
Yeah, like, I thought it was. I just thought that, oh, kids just get punched when you do something, make your parents mad. I don't know why. But so I just assumed that that was normal. And when she told me that, that's when the wheels started turning. Like, okay, my house is not like everybody else's. And then I was probably, oh man, was I 13 or 14? It was when I dropped my sister off at college when we did that. It was like 2003 or 2004. But we were at a dinner and there were a bunch of pastors at the table and they had taken us out to eat. And I can't remember what event it was, but there were a lot of different pastors from different churches there. And there was this one pastor like sitting across from me and he asked about our church. And I told him the truth. So at this point, we had already moved into our apartment. Nobody was really coming to this church. And then we were on furlough in the States. So it's like in between us moving to my grandmother's house. So I told him, I just said, sometimes it's just our family. That's it. You know, we used to have people, but they don't really go there anymore. So he looked at me and he just said, oh, okay. So sometimes it's just you and your family. And he started asking more questions. And my mom noticed that we were having a conversation. So she interrupted and she said, oh, no, she means kids. There's sometimes no kids. It doesn't mean there's nobody there. And I remember looking at her like, wait a minute, where are you going with this? And she told him that we usually had 15 people attending the church. And I'm thinking, who who? Who are these people? Because at that point, it was me, my two siblings, and my parents. Like, I didn't know we had additional people in this house. So I just looked at her, and I remember confronting her about it later. And of course, it was not met well. Later, there were things that happened as a response to what I had said. So I learned very quickly not to talk about things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they flat out lied to the guy and just said there were 15 people, unicorns.
And you're how old here?
I'm like 13 or 14, roughly. Because it was when I was dropping off my sister in college. And she is, was I 14? Maybe I was 14. It's hard sometimes. Those years are really all mushed together.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was definitely a teenager at that point.
And that's another kind of formative time of life. Like, you have like middle school, and then you've got like your teenage trying to figure out who you are outside of your family, which is like, I feel like middle school is like, who am I in my family? Am I the smart one? Or am I the whatever? Am I the, you know, I realized quickly I wasn't, but am I whatever you are? Am I like, who am I in the family? Like, how do people respond to me? And then like teenagers, like, who am I going to be when I leave this family? Right. And like, for you, when you saw that, was it just confusion, or was there some part of you as you started going toward adulthood that was like resentment of like, I'm just living with like these liars, you know? Like, how did you categorize that?
It was really tough. Of course, going back to Japan after that furlough, the abuse just got worse. As soon as my sister left for college, my dad got more physically aggressive.
Is it because he felt safer? Like, is it because he felt like there's less people to step in?
I don't know if that was the case. I think he was dealing with a lot of my sister moving away. Maybe it was that he didn't have control over her anymore. That could have been what it was. I don't know. It's hard to say. I do know out of all of us siblings, she was kind of his favorite, even though he did abuse her. I mean, she went through some terrible things, but she was kind of his favorite. And so when she left, all hell broke loose, and there was nothing holding him back at that point. Right. So, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about like your kind of, I guess, personal view. Like, did this affect your faith, or was it something where like you just, cause like, I feel like there's one of two, like for me, when I started, you know, and I don't have the similar story at all, but like, I know for me, when I started having things break down about like, this is inconsistent. I think that's the one similarity, is like there's inconsistencies we notice as a kid or as a teenager. Like for me, it was like pulling a thread, and then it started all unraveling, and, you know, still in a lot of ways keeps unraveling. And then other people I talk to, it's like a category. It's like, yeah, my parents were bad, but I, in my mind, was like, well, that's not me. Right. So like, did it affect your faith? Did you rebel at all? Like, how did you act up until like that college age?
So I would say I started to become like them. I was very judgmental.
Mm. You kind of fell in line with
them a little bit. Yeah. I had no choice. It was either that or you can't mentally make it. You really can't.
Like, well, you don't have any other perspective. Yeah. Like, without the safety nets of even a sibling, or like, what else, what other perspective can you follow? Like, you haven't seen anything else modeled than that. Yeah.
Yeah. And especially since at that point, so moved back when I was 15, my grandma passes away when I'm 16, and then we move into her house. Her house was like, oh gosh, an hour and a half away from like the military base and everything that I knew at that point. And even living there, it was very restricted as far as where we were allowed to go or even leaving the house. Like, it was tough. But as soon as we moved into my grandma's house, I mean, there were some days my mom would scream at me just for taking out the trash. Like, I had to ask for permission to do that. And I'm 16 years old at this point.
Yeah. You know?
So there was a lot that I was dealing with. And I remember having conversations with my mom on days things got really bad in the home. I was also homeschooled, which never left the home. You know, I was just home all day. Or if I did go anywhere, it was with my parents. Or sometimes I was, and this was what really confused me, I was allowed to go to the park up the road with my brother, who was younger than me. I don't understand this whole, like, you have to have a man with you everywhere you go.
Right.
I don't understand. But you know, just seeing that, I ask my mom sometimes, like, why don't you just leave dad? Why do you stay here? Because I didn't realize that she was also abusive. I kind of felt sorry for her at that time. So I would ask her things like that. Why don't you just leave dad? And she would say things like, the righteous endure suffering. And she would say things like, you know, we go through bad things and it's only to make us stronger. And then she would pull stories about, is it Corrie ten Boom who was in the Holocaust?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. She would pull stories like that. Very twisted, because that woman went through so much. Like, she, you know, I'm not knocking her story.
Well, and if you find yourself relating to a Holocaust survivor in terms of your marriage, your marriage is not in a good place.
No, yeah. Right. Definitely not. So she would say stories like that and say, look, see what they went through. And then they got out, and I'm thinking, okay, are you saying that that's me? Like, do I have to go through more, things to just like make it? But she would say things like, the righteous endure suffering. And, so that's what I had ingrained in my head. I thought that this was what I had to deal with or live with. But I did adapt a very judgmental, condescending mindset. And then I brought that with me to a very strict religious school. So, 18, I go to a college, which I ended up meeting some really amazing people. I met my husband there. I met friends that I will probably be forever friends with there. But I think the people I got very close to were also people who grew up in similar environments. We may not have talked about it, but looking back now, when we've had those conversations, it's like, that's why I could relate to you. That's why we understood each other.
Well, and like I said, like, and none of you would have known it was abnormal, because you're all, you know what I mean? So you've got this weird shared experience. Like,
hey, everybody, we're going to get back to the show in just a minute. But before our brief intermission, I'd like to introduce a thought-provoking new podcast called Psychotherapy. That's two words if you're going to go search for it right now. This show sheds light on the very real issue of abusive therapists and pastoral counselors. In every helping profession, including therapy, there's a vulnerability to exploitation. And Psychotherapy delves deep into the red flags, risks, and real-life stories of those affected by unethical practices. Tune in to Psychotherapy with Leah Denton on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your shows.
I'm Leah Denton, and this is Psychotherapy, a show dedicated to providing survivors of therapy harm a platform to share their stories and to offer language for those of us trying to make sense of our own experiences with the psycho in the therapist chair.
We talk about this on Figuring Out all the time. Like there's things now that I'll say that I'm like, oh, that's weird, you know, or you don't know until someone's looking at you. Like, you're like, yeah, like, yeah. So it's like the story you shared, which is an extreme example, but it's like, oh, I got in trouble. Like, that's in your mind. You're like, I got in trouble. So this happened, you know, same thing, like sharing any experience, like, oh, the pastor said this, and people look at you like, what? That's crazy.
Yeah.
So starting to realize that, because getting outside of that environment was probably scary, but also freeing in a lot of ways. Like, what was Bible college like? Because, like, it's always crazy to me when I talk to someone who goes, like, I was in a very bad, strict, rigid home life, and then college felt like a breath of fresh air. Because, like, even though, like, to most people that went to Bible college, they'd be like, I felt so constricted, you know? So, like, what was the feeling there? Was it a positive thing overall?
Oh, yeah. At least for me, I arrived on campus very underweight. I was anorexic. I was 72 pounds when I got on that campus. Like, I should not have been walking. But I met people who were kind and genuinely cared about me and didn't care that I was wearing a turtleneck sweater in 90 degree weather with a huge overcoat. Like, they didn't care. They just wanted to be kind to me. And that was the breath of fresh air for me. Sure, there were, you know, people that weren't so nice. And the rules were pretty strict. Would I go back now? Absolutely not.
Sure.
No.
Well, many things can be true, right? Yeah. Like, I talk about this all the time. Like, all of my good memories and bad memories of the first 18 years of my life were within one place.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, I have good memories, and I've had people say, like, well, you had good memories. So it's like, it validates everything else. But it's like, Yeah, main thing is just like your mom. Your mom was a victim and an abuser. Yeah. Two things can be true. She still has to bear responsibility right. for and own the abuse side. Yeah. I do want to touch briefly, and again, as yeah. much detail as you want to go into, but you know, you mentioned and you've shared images before on like Instagram of like how skinny you were going to college. Like, was the eating disorder something fueled by something you were taught? Was it just a side effect of being depressed and not like, were you consciously aware of what you were doing at that time? Or was it just something that happened?
Yes and no. So it's very complicated, especially when sure. you're talking about an eating disorder, because for different people it can mean different
right.
things. For me, I think I developed an eating disorder probably way before then. Mm-hmm. When I was 12,
wow.
my mom made fun of my weight. And diets were highly encouraged in our home.
Like, sure.
You know, if you're not skinny, then you're not good enough. My sister was also treated that way, which later she discovered she has a autoimmune disease. Like that, wow. that's what she was going through. And she was met with criticism and ridiculed for her body. And I was the same way. Like I hit puberty and gained some weight and my mom made fun of me for that.
Which is just normal.
Yeah.
yeah.
It's just normal in our household, you know? So I started going on diets at 12. And then when we moved into my grandmother's house and the abuse got really bad, I was on somewhat of a diet at that point too. I don't remember a time I wasn't after puberty.
Wow.
But I started going into it and then I stopped eating at dinner because it was just so painful to sit there and listen to my dad yell and scream, and making dinner time as brief as possible was right. the best thing for me. But then I started noticing the pain that came with restrictive eating to the point where, not to get like graphic or anything, but basically there's like, it's hard to describe. It's like a burning feeling in your back when you've hit starvation mode for so long. And that became my source of comfort. So for me to go to sleep at night with that feeling was the only way I could fall asleep. It kept my mind away from the emotional pain. And I could focus on just being in physical pain versus what was going on around me. Of course, there was still physical abuse going on, but
right.
you know, just all the
it's things. A distraction or, yeah, it was, or it's a something that you can control too, yeah. which is, you know, like, I mean, that's self-harm in general. Was, like that's yeah. what people with cutting or thing, like it's a pain you can control. Yeah. And, you know, and again, like you said, there's partly it's intentional, partly not understanding why it's yeah. happening. How long did it take? I mean, college is, like you said, it was probably healing in a lot of ways, being around good people yeah. that are kind was good. When did you realize like, okay, I'm not in a good place, you know, cause that, yeah. that probably I'm assuming took a while if you know.
Yeah. I mean, I had plenty of people telling me,
you hey.
Know, yeah, you don't look so great. You know,
oh, thanks. That makes me feel better.
yeah, yeah. I feel great about myself. You know, I had an aunt that was, very concerned for me mm-hmm. and I went and stayed at her house. This was pre-college. I went to stay at her house for an afternoon. My parents were in the living room with her and I don't know what I was doing, but I was like out in the yard. And then I came in the house and she was crying mm-hmm. and she was begging them to have me get help mm-hmm. because she knew where I was headed. And she had seen that, I guess one of her granddaughter's classmates had either died or had to go wow. through rehab. Because of it. And she was saying, please don't let this happen to her. Like she's not doing well. And my parents of course dismissed it. And I ended up asking them if I could go to a rehab facility mm-hmm. because I knew where I was headed. Of course they said no. And they said that was because of my sin, that I was going through this. So once I, started living, not simply, then this would also go away as well.
Yeah.
So, I was starting to wonder if that wasn't true. Cause I was like, I've been praying for a very long time,
yeah.
That everything around me would stop, whether it was the physical abuse, mental abuse, or right. even the fact that I was so out of control at this point, I couldn't even control my own eating disorder. Like it started out, yeah. you know, somewhat being able to control it. And then now to this point where like, I have no control over myself. Like right. I've lost everything. So I asked them if I could go to a rehab facility. Of course they said no. And then I went to college and I knew that I wasn't doing well for one. Like I hadn't had a menstrual period in like months. Sorry, very graphic, but I knew I wasn't doing well. And I actually had a friend in college who was, I forget what major she was, but she was taking some sort of class where she had to do like a physical. And she took me with her. I don't know if this was intentional. I've never asked her about this, but she took me with her. And we saw the nurse. And the nurse took my height and weight. And she said, hey, just wanted to let you know that you are currently not in a healthy range for your height and age. And for a woman your age, she gave me like basically the metrics of what I should sure. be looking at. And that kind of woke something up inside of me because I was like, oh, I didn't realize I was that far off, like yeah. that, you know, not doing so great. So that started to make me think about that. Recovery was a very long process. I dipped in and out of it multiple times. I was doing really well until, I forget, it was it my sophomore year? I think it was my sophomore year. Yeah. Sophomore year, I ended up going back for the summer and I ended up relapsing again. Of course, dude, no wonder why. No. But yeah, it was little moments. It wasn't like this big aha awakening. It right. was little moments that kind of pushed me towards recovery and realizing that I deserve to get help and it was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did that all tie in with like all the other areas, like I'm going to live differently than my family? Or was that something that after you got that solved, you were able to focus on the deeper traumas wow. and 'cause again, like nothing ever happens in a linear way. Like, but I mean, obviously now you recognize how bad it was with your yeah. parents or how bad, like, was that just part of that healing work where that came into play? Or was it a, once you solved the eating disorder, then it was like, here's the other layer yeah. to it.
I think in the back of my mind, I always knew it was wrong. What was going on? I mean, of course, when I was really little, I had no concept of that until right. I went to my friend's house and she was like, no, this is not okay. But I think I was trying to still cover for them.
Yeah.
And
did you yeah. do that because you felt bad for them? Or was it scary for you to think, that you were, like you had put the time into something that wasn't real? Like what was the, you know,
yeah, that's
I'm asking very easy questions. Right? Okay.
that's no, a really good no. way of putting it though. Yeah.
Cause it is like, it's yeah. like, sometimes I think people justify because they're like, I spent 20 years in this. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be wrong for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think that definitely had a part to play in that for sure. I think probably around my junior sophomore year of college, I was starting to realize that I didn't want to be anything like what my parents were doing.
Right.
And then it wasn't until leaving college, because I didn't graduate from there initially. I ended up graduating later with an interdisciplinary degree. But after leaving college, I think I started to realize that my parents were not changing. Right. I think in my head I had developed this narrative like, oh, they're going to become,
they're growing. They're, yeah. yeah.
Because I'm growing, right? As I'm learning things. So they must be growing too. And there's no way that someone can stay the same. And you know, all these narratives in my head. So I leave college and they end up disowning me, because I don't have enough money to go back. So, they disowned me. And I felt like it was my fault, but I also had good friends at that point who were like, no, that's not normal. Like people don't just do that.
No.
And then of course, Seth and I were engaged at this point too, as well, which that was also a whole other roller coaster, like trying to date with all these
yeah.
people telling you what to do, on the other side of the world, which I don't know why I gave them that much control. Now that I think about it, I could have literally done anything with my life, but it's that mental.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't know that.
You really don't. I'm like, they could fly over here any minute. Yeah. But after leaving college and then they disowned me because I couldn't go back, I was working as a waitress and my dad had a lot of things to say about that because it wasn't good enough. And I was just making ends meet. So they disowned me. And then I ended up applying to become a flight attendant for Delta. So I got in as a interpreter because I speak Japanese and English. I get in, I graduate, and all of a sudden they want to be back in my life again. And then I started to realize there's a little pattern going on here. Unless I could give them something of value, I was no value to them. So realizing that helped me to kind of go in a direction where I was allowing myself to ask those questions. Like, is this really okay?
Yeah.
Are these really safe people? Are these good people? Mm. And if not, then it's okay to admit that. But it took me years to finally come to a point where I was just like, you know, enough is enough. Like, this is not okay. I wish that aha moment came sooner, but truthfully, it didn't happen until 2017. And that was when they disowned me for the very last time. And I was not doing well. And I ended up going to therapy. And then that's when I started really healing and growing. So I would say, as far as being able to heal, that hasn't happened until like the last few years.
Yeah.
But there's definitely been little moments here and there that's kind of pushed me towards that direction. So
2017, disowning you for another time. And what was the reason for that? Was it something similar to the call, or was it just a, you don't have to share if you don't want to.
I've really tried to make sense of this. I really have. When I first started therapy, I had a really good therapist in Florida, and she even looked at me and said, that's an interesting reason. I went to Japan in 2017 because my dad was really sick. He had collapsed, and he was taken to a hospital by ambulance. Turns out he had a bleeding ulcer. So of our siblings, I was the only one that could fly back and see what was going on. Just because, you know, days off, that type of thing.
Yeah.
So I flew over there to see what was going on, see how he was doing. Of course, I had tried to think that the ministry situation had changed because my mom said some things over Facebook that made me think that things were changing. Of course, you know, still the same. I was like,
you're just reading her version of things again.
That's not cool. But I saw my dad in the hospital and he was really happy to see me. We had some really good conversations and I'm thinking, oh, this is going great. Maybe we're healing. Cause I'd spent, you know, a good amount of time trying to make this relationship work. And even when I was a flight attendant and I would fly to Japan, I would meet up with them. And I thought, okay, we're working our way towards something good here.
Yeah.
So when I saw him in the hospital, he was really excited to see me. We had some really good conversations. But then I realized that there were things in the home that were putting his health in jeopardy.
Right.
For one, my mom has and this is not to diminish anyone that has struggle with this, because to me this isn't a joke, but my mom has a severe hoarding addiction, and to the point where the only food available in the house was things that were not good for my dad's health.
Yeah.
And the doctor even told my mom he needs to change his diet because he has high blood pressure, he's getting older, he has a bleeding ulcer, this is internal stuff, these are things that can be managed. So, the doctor even asked him, do you smoke? Because his blood pressure was
so high.
So
bad. Yeah.
It was terrible. And he said, no, I don't smoke. You know, thinking about it, I can see a couple reasons why he could be suffering from bad health due to, you know, not taking care of the anger issues. I've been there before myself and I know what anger can do to your blood pressure, and it's bad. So there's that. And then of course the diet situation, he doesn't have proper nutrients in the home. So I confronted my mom about it, and my sister and my brother all agreed that they needed some help, whether it was having someone in the house a few times a month to help them out, or even seeing a therapist, just because things had gotten pretty rough. So I came back to the States, fully expecting things to go well. I helped my mom clean the house. She'd even promised me she would see a counselor. Mm-hmm. And we'd agreed upon that. So I come back, my sister, my brother and I have a conversation. And then we spend 2 weeks to really think about all this. And then, of course, all three of us were praying about it and thinking about what resources would be the best way to, I wasn't trying to make them feel bad, you know. So we ended up getting on a Skype conversation, and things got pretty bad really quick. Apparently, my mom had taken things out of the trash, and the whole house was a disaster when my dad came home, and he said that I had come over there to cause problems, and he immediately went into telling us that we shouldn't worry about when he was dying, because the inheritance would be split three ways. So he was accusing me of wanting to watch him die, and therefore money, which I really don't. I don't want any of that. I mean, I don't believe in curses per se, but if there's any type of money that is cursed, I do not want any of that.
Yeah, right.
Considering how it was attained.
Made, yeah.
So, you know, I was really shocked by what they had to say. And because the conversation got so bad, I did have to remove myself from that call. But before that happened, my dad made it very, very clear that he did not want me or my sister in his life anymore. Mm-hmm. We asked him to confirm in both languages just to make sure we didn't hear him wrong. And he said, yep, don't need you guys anymore. My mom just sat there, nodded her head.
Wow.
And I got off the call and had a panic attack. And of course, my mom tried to pretend like nothing had happened. Yeah. Very passive aggressive. There were still Facebook comments, which was really weird to me. You know? So I reached out to her privately. And I just told her, I basically laid down some boundaries as far as what was appropriate, what was not appropriate. I was not there for this, but from what I understand, my sister cut off her camera and there were some things said about her. So, again, I wasn't there for this, but I reached out to my mom via private message and I just said, hey, you guys made it very clear that you don't want us in your life. I understand that there were some things said about my sister. So until you can apologize to her, I'd prefer you not leave comments in public unless you can have this conversation in private, because to me, this doesn't seem genuine and I don't appreciate that.
More for appearances like the other side.
I mean, there were sponsoring churches that were viewing all of our Facebooks who had no idea what was going on. So after that, I did not hear anything from her. I think I might have gotten one or two passive aggressive emails since this has been, gosh, it's been over 5 years now, but in the 5 year time span, I might've gotten two passive aggressive emails and haven't responded. Don't really see the reason I should. But that pushed me to a really, really dark place. I was suicidal, and, all of 2017, I was really trying to numb that out. Like I'd always done, you know, find something to keep yourself busy. Try not to think. I put myself into volunteering, which is a good thing, but so much so that I didn't have time to even think about
anything. It was another coping mechanism.
It was. And I hate to admit that, because what I was doing was good, but my intentions were wrong.
Right.
And it was just me trying to numb the pain. I don't think I even realized it then, but looking back, that's what was going on. And in December, I found myself in a psychiatric facility. I admitted myself because I knew where my mind was going, and I had my poor husband, like, he was too scared to go to work because he was afraid he'd come home and I wouldn't be there. So I checked myself in, and there was a doctor there who told me, and she was just very understanding. And I think at that point I knew that therapy was okay. I had seen a Christian counselor previous to this, not really a therapist, but I think there was still a part of me that was latching on to medication is bad. You know, seeing a psychiatrist is bad. All these things that I was taught as a kid were still very prevalent in my mind. And she told me, she said, look, I know that you're a faith-based person. I know you pray, and that's good. But it takes all legs in your chair to be stable. And right now you're only leaning on like one or two. So I would highly recommend, if you can, please see a psychiatrist. I, as much as you've been lovely to speak to, I don't want to see you here ever again. And that's what she told me. And it kind of made me laugh a little bit, but she was right. You know, I had kind of put this weight, this pressure on myself to kind of just make it without seeking professional help. So I ended up having to tell my boss what happened and told him where I was. I wasn't there for very long, but I still had to tell him, you know, what was going on. And he was very understanding, and he connected me with our Works employee assistance program.
Yeah.
So I got in touch with a licensed therapist and a psychiatrist. Yeah. And it was January 2018.
So, yeah. I mean, obviously, like, going to therapy once doesn't change your life. No. It's a process, and I'm sure it's a process that you, there's probably not an end in sight. Like, no. You're going to be, it's going to be constantly learning and like, and growing and things like that. But, you know, kind of as we get near the end, like I try to be careful, you know, how I ask these questions, because I never want to make people who feel like they resonate with where you were with the story you just told, mm-hmm. they're at that moment right now. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to think that like they're a lesser person because they're not enlightened or they're not whatever the word someone could throw at them. What does healing and recovery mean to you? What does it look like? Cause it's, I think we tend to look at like, you're either in a bad place or a good place. Mm-hmm. And it's not like that. Yeah. You know, there's days, it's like your physical health. There's days going to the gym sucks worse than other days, you know? And then there's,
I want pizza today.
You know, right. Yeah. And, stay home. and so there's all these things, but what has recovery meant to you over the last couple of years? Because it's hard to picture, you know, the person that I know now, it's hard to picture that just a few years ago, you felt completely hopeless. Cause like now you're sharing these stories, you're talking and sharing so openly and it, I mean, from all outside perspectives in a really good place, you know, what does that look like for you? What does it look like moving forward?
Yeah. I think healing to me beings, can't talk words mixed backwards. Okay.
Words make backwards. Yes, they do.
Oh gosh. I think healing for me just means being honest with yourself, with exactly where you're at now, like in this present moment, not where do you want to be. I mean, it's good to have that insight, but I think it's being honest and vulnerable with yourself as to where you're currently at. And I think that was the biggest struggle that I had to face, was being real.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up thinking that I had to hide everything, or I had some sort of very Christianese phrase to cover up every emotion. Like, God is good all the time. That's nice. Hmm. But it doesn't mean that.
Doesn't explain what I'm feeling
exactly,
right now.
Right. Yeah. And you know, I think a lot of Christians are afraid of that. They're afraid of being real, to say what they're really going through. And I think a lot of it has to do with either verses being taken out of context or ways that they were raised, this almost sense of toxic positivity, you know, being happy all the time and everything's good all the time. No, everything's not good all the time. And I think it's okay to admit that. I'm actually starting therapy again next week. Since I've moved here, I had a therapist, things didn't work out, schedules didn't work out. And I have a new one that's, I hope works out. But, you know, I don't think there's, like you were saying, I don't think there is an end in sight.
But that's the thing, is like going, we were raised, I mean, I was raised, my family didn't really talk about therapy and stuff, but like from the leaders I was around, like youth pastor and stuff, it was like, people in a bad place go to therapy or counseling, you know? And it's like, I talked with a trauma therapist who's been on the show, Claire Horner, who I talk about all the time. And she told me, she's like, when you go see a therapist, the first question should be what do you see a therapist? Because every therapist that you're seeing should be seeing a therapist, yeah, you know? and we look at it as like this sign of like defeat, like, or like this, it's not, it's like, it's just like you work on anything else. It's working on your mental health.
Yeah.
I want to ask this one kind of last-ish question. I'm sure we'll have one more button on this, but how do you balance, because like you're very positive, I would say, you know, when you're talking, like you're, you know, you can joke about certain things or you can be a positive voice on a lot of things, but also you embrace the bad and face it head on with your posts, with your conversation, like one-to-one. What do you see as the difference between admitting that something bad happened or acknowledging something bad happened without sitting in the bad? Because like a few years ago, it seems like you didn't know how to not sit in it. Yeah. Like there was this toxicity that you were in, and rightfully so, like by yourself, you shouldn't, like there were no tools to get past that. How do you go about balancing, acknowledging the bad things that are happening, the really sucky things in life without, you know, without just dwelling in that to where it's bringing you back down?
You mean like being stuck or?
Yeah, like being stuck. Because I think like, for example, like situation with your parents, you acknowledge that's bad, but like you could sit there for the rest of your life and go, I'm just waiting for them to change and then my life can be good. Mm-hmm. You know, like how do you balance that being positive without it being this false positivity or acknowledging there's bad without I can't see any good? You know, there's a weird balance there.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is just, again, back to the honesty of seeing both things, but also being patient. I think a lot of times people think stuff like this happens overnight. It's like, I'm good, you know?
Yeah. If only.
Yeah, that'd be great, you know? I mean, I'm 32 and I'm still dealing with trauma from when I was 9. And that's a long time to be dealing with that, you know? So it's not something that happens overnight. And I think it's genuinely okay to have time where you sit in that pain and you think, oh, this is terrible. Like this is, there's nothing good about this. And there's no positive on this at all. And I think it's okay to feel that way. I think a lot of people who are Christians, or have faith as their background think they can cheat the system.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the stages of grief, they think they don't have to go through anger. You're going to go through it. You're either going to go through it by doing healthy things like going to therapy and talking it out, or having exercises your therapist give you to work through anger in a healthy way, or it's going to come out on your kids or your people at work. You're going to end up micromanaging them, treating them like garbage. Like that's another way.
Or people, yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Or self-harm. Like
someone's going to, it's not victimless.
No, someone is going to get hurt, and it's either you or someone you love or someone you're very close with. And I think people don't realize that until it's too late.
Yeah.
And you know, that's happened to me multiple times where, the first time I went to counseling, again, I didn't go to a licensed therapist till years later, but, I did go to a Christian counselor a few years after we were married for anger, because I lashed out at my husband multiple times. He was either trying to like tap me on the shoulder or like give me a hug, or like one time it was like a playful swat on the behind, and it should not have triggered me, but it did. And it never triggered me before, but something happened in that moment where a switch flipped and I lost it and like just became very aggressive and angry and started screaming. And months later I went to counseling for that. But even with that, you know, somebody was suffering.
Yeah.
My husband was.
Right.
You know, and like people at work didn't know that because I kept it all in. And then when I came home, it was like this time bomb just exploded. So I think it's, you know, being real, being honest, and allowing yourself to feel grief, to feel anger, feel sadness. It doesn't have to control your life, at least not forever. But I think if anybody should give grace, it should be Christians. And it should be the people that talk about grace the most should be the ones to be understanding when a victim comes forward and says, I'm just angry. I just want to punch a wall. Like those are normal emotions in response to abuse. But I think when we try to bottle those up is we don't heal. We just stay stuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No. Dr. Jessica Taylor, wrote in her book, you know, there's no abnormal reaction to an abnormal circumstance. You know, I don't know if that's her quote or if that's someone else, but that to me, like when people go like, why is someone so mad or why is someone going about it? I'm like, just look at the situation, you know, like there's a process. And like, again, there's going to be things that are messy,
yeah,
but it's a normal response to a messy, messy situation. Yeah. But I really appreciate you like showing both sides of that, because I think there's a lot of people that do similar work to what you do, or they work in similar things to what I do with advocacy, and they paint this like you can be healed, or you know, you could be better, or you can be better, you can be this, you can be that. And I love that you share posts and messages and do conversations where you talk about the times it's really hard and then the times where like this is something that's really helping. And because I think it's discouraging when you see people like who look like they have it all together all the time. And then they're like, you could be like me if you'll do this. And it's like, I can't even imagine that, you know, that road.
I'm sorry. I just immediately had a thought. Somebody reached out to me. It was an MLM thing. And read that I was struggling through depression. And they told me that there was a supplement I could take. And I was like, thank you.
Perfect.
Perfect. Healed no, miracles.
That's funny. Well, look, I mean, I could talk for real for a long time. And it's really stupid that we haven't talked in a year in person. But if you could leave the person listening to this, I mean, we've covered a lot of really good stuff. You could leave people listening with like one message, like for the people, if you're talking to Asami from, you know, 4 years ago or 5 years ago, what do you wish someone would have told you?
It's okay that you're angry and I'm not going anywhere. I think my husband did tell me that, but
yeah,
I mean, I think that's what I would have needed to hear the most is it's okay to be angry. It really is.
No, I think that's really good for people to hear. And I think a good place to close. The dogs agree, but no, I really do. I appreciate you. And I hope it's not the last time we talk general, but definitely, and hopefully not only behind microphones, but thank you for sharing that. Cause I think people really need to hear it. If people want to connect with you on like social, they want to see all the stuff I'm talking about, all the posts I'm talking about, what's the best place for them to do that?
The best place for them to do that is probably Instagram, or my website. My Instagram is mentalhealthisami, and then my website is just isamidane.com. Awesome. So either one of those would be great.
Cool. Yeah. If you're listening, be sure to check out the link in the show notes, connect with Asami there. There's a lot of really great posts, resources, things like that. Definitely worth checking out. But thanks again for joining me. And hopefully we won't wait another year.
Hopefully not. Thanks for having me. So, yes.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes. And don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.